Hi, I'm Amalia. I'm a current student and I'm the host of Sharing Things. Sharing Things is a conversation between two people who have just met, but who share a connection to the university. We start with a meaningful object that they have brought to the studio and we take it from there. In this episode, you will meet James Crawford and Shai Swaloon. James is a writer, publisher, and broadcaster, and the presenter of BBC's Scotland from the Sky. Shai is a law student involved in Women in Law and Edinburgh International Justice Initiative. Let's see where this takes us.
Nice, nice, nice.
This is very weird.
I know.
I'm not used to hearing my voice like this.
Yeah. But it's kind of fun. Okay, so welcome to Sharing Things. We usually start each conversation by asking the same question, which is, what have you brought to the studio and why?
I will start. Yeah. I've brought a piece of the Berlin Wall.
Ooh.
But it's probably not a piece of the Berlin Wall. I bought it about 7 years ago on eBay when I was writing a book. I was writing a book about lost buildings all around the world, going from the earliest times up to the present day. And one of the buildings, one of the structures, was the Berlin Wall. And partly for inspiration, I decided I want to try and to acquire a piece. So I bought it on eBay. As I say, I suspect it's not real because there was a kind of market for these pieces of the wall. When it came down, I was 11 years old when it came down in 1989. And people would come from all over the world and were called Mauerspechte, and they would hack away at the wall and take their little bit. You could hire a hammer for a few Deutschmarks and hack away at it. Very quickly, the western side, which was the side that had graffiti on it, all those pieces had gone. Now, actually, the more interesting side, in a way, is the eastern side, the side that was keeping people in. But people wanted the western side because the thing that showed up that it was a piece of the Berlin Wall was the markings, the graffiti on it. So the eastern side was spray painted to make it seem more authentic. So I hope that my piece is one of those spray painted eastern pieces. But the reality is it's probably a bit of rock from a building site that someone has put some paint on and sold on eBay. But I'm fine with that. That's okay. I think that's all right.
I think that almost makes it better. You know, not knowing adds a bit of a mystery to
it. It's like Schrodinger's wall.
Exactly.
Do you know, it's that idea. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't want to ever know. But
no.
I like the kind of sense of power that just this tiny little thing with this kind of, it's got, you know, it fits in the palm of my hand. It's got yellow, brown paint on it.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a piece of the Berlin Wall.
Maybe it is.
But maybe it's not.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, it's better not knowing.
I don't think we'll ever find out.
That's okay.
What do you feel like it means to you? Does it remind you of something?
I mean, one of the things, when I was writing this book, a lot of the places I was writing about, I hadn't necessarily been to, partly because it's very difficult to get to them. Some of them were in Iraq, for instance, or in the jungles of Peru. Some of them I had been to. The Berlin Wall, I had been to the site of it, but one of the things with the Berlin Wall, as I say, I was 11 when it came down, is I'd grown up with it. And I'd grown up with it as something that was almost normal. You just accept it, particularly when you're young. You kind of accept things like that. But the idea that there was this line that divided the world, in a sense, in half, was fascinating to me. And when I was growing up, my older brother used to buy these comics called 2000 AD. I don't know if anyone is aware of that anymore. People like Judge Dredd came out of it, and it was all kind of set in a post-apocalyptic world, and you know, there'd been a nuclear war and things had just gone wrong, and they were very kind of counter-cultural and subversive. And there was almost kind of, as a young person, inevitability that that was what was going to happen to the world, you know, the kind of fatalistic view that there was going to be a nuclear war. And you just, you know, as a kid, you just think, well, I guess that's going to happen. You know, we had friends who had a bunker somewhere in Scotland. They said, oh, you can, if the 5-minute warning sounds, you can come and stay in that bunker.
Oh, wow.
And it seems ludicrous to think back about that now. Also, they lived more than 5 minutes away, so we wouldn't have got there in time. And then for that thing, that structure that was almost a symbol of this division of the world, for that to come down was quite a big, you know, it was quite a big moment. Even at 11, I experienced that as quite a significant moment. So of all the places that I wrote about, in a way, that was the one that was closest, not necessarily to my heart, but psychologically, it was the one I was closest to and felt most of a connection with, because it was something I was always aware that was there. It was almost like a dark fairy tale of my childhood that was suddenly gone.
I just picked up on, you mentioned, just speaking of comics, I see that you have brought a a comic.
It feels a lot less special now that someone's sitting next to me with a piece of the Berlin Wall.
No.
But it's maybe not a piece. It's maybe just a bit of rock from a building site.
But it might also be.
It might also be.
Yes. That's so special. Okay, well, I guess I'll talk about mine.
Yeah.
I brought a comic book from home. It's the indispensable Calvin and Hobbes, which is a comic book written by, I think, a Canadian comic artist called Bill Watterson. I might be butchering the delivery of his name, but, you know, we try. I grew up in Tanzania, so for a very long time we didn't really manage to get post. So this was, I think, one of our first Amazon deliveries. My mum's going to correct me on this. And it was so odd to finally get a delivery with, like, books that I was, you know, wishing for ages. And this one's one of them. And I've brought it everywhere with me. I took it to boarding school. I took it when I moved into my first adult apartment. And now it's in Edinburgh with me. And, I mean, you can tell from the wear how much I read it. And it's still got little tabs in it from, you know, my favourite comics when I was, like, 9. So it's a bit sentimental to me. And whenever I'm feeling a bit down, I just kind of pull it off the shelf and have a look at it. It makes me feel young again.
Do you read it differently?
I think so, yeah. I pulled it out for the first time in a while when I was trying to pick out what I'd bring here. And I looked at the comics and I feel more like the mum than I do like Calvin. And that's a bit depressing because the mum's always such a downer. Like, I remember reading them when I was little and thinking, oh, she's mean. And now I relate to her. Realised I'm an adult all of a sudden. Very odd realisation to have.
Yeah.
But do you think that will change again as you get older?
I don't know. I really hope so. I'd like to feel like Calvin again. Feel a bit, you know, adventurous and mischievous. But I think when you reach that middle stage where you're trying to figure out what adult life is, you kind of lose that sense for a little bit.
And at first, was it Calvin you identified?
Oh, yeah, easily. It was Calvin getting around, making fun of people. Like, not mainly making fun of people, but having these very childish thoughts. And, yeah, I got him, which I think is part of the appeal for me when I was little. It was very relatable. I didn't really relate to a lot of the, you know, the girly stuff, the stereotypically girly stuff. So this was always a bit of a savior. Yeah.
How do you feel about it now?
I don't know. It's, you know, there are some things in your childhood that you don't really like to question. They're kind of almost like the Berlin Wall. They kind of are. And this book is, you know, just a book to me. So I don't know how I think about it. Mm. It just is.
It just is.
It just is.
Yeah. Kind of like that. Do you have a favorite story in it?
Oh, I think there was one I was reading with my partner the other day. There's, it's a really simple comic strip. It's just 4 panels. And it's Calvin waking his mum up. And she's all angry that he's woken him up at 2 a.m. And she walks into his room. And he asks her the question, is it true that humans are made of spores? And she gets all angry at him. And is the whole, I guess, the whole special part of this comic is that he's got a teddy bear called Hobbs, but he sees him as alive. So he and the teddy bear have, like, a conversation about him saying, oh, it's a secret, your mum just didn't want to tell you. And it's cute. It feels almost like, you know, how we see adults as children. You know, we see them as hiding things. And then when you grow up, you realize they're not really hiding things. They're just tired all the time. Mm. That's a bit depressing.
Tired,
oh my gosh,
all the time. Yeah.
As the father of 2 children, I can testify to
that. Is that it?
That's why I had a coffee on the way in here. My third of the day.
Tired all the time.
Tired all the time.
Yeah. I sometimes think about the fact that you can never really know your parents. Because they have lived this whole life before you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things having children now is you start to inhabit 2 places at once. You re-inhabit childhood because you start to see things again through their eyes. But then you also have a different understanding of your own parents. And, I mean, the reality is that there is no such thing as an adult. I think that's what you realise. They're just people who've got older, who've got the same issues, the same problems, and just more responsibilities to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But no one ever really grows up.
Yeah.
And, you know, perception of things changes, but I think particularly reliving things through my own children, and, you know, there's good and bad things about that. There's excitement. You relive the excitement of things that you liked or that they are suddenly getting passionate and excited about. And that's fantastic.
Like, for example, what?
It might be something like Star Wars, or it might be, you know, books that you read as a child that they're starting to read or starting to appreciate. And, you know, the kind of the wonder and the magic and that journey that lies ahead of them. You know, particularly my oldest son, who's just 7, just the other day finished reading his first book by himself. You know, and he started wearing a head torch at night to read in bed. You know, and that's fantastic because you think about the journeys that he will go on through literature and through books, that he won't go on with me. And that's brilliant, because I think that's all those kind of worlds that he will be able to explore through through writing. And, you know, publishing and writing and books are a big part of my life. So to see that emerging within him is fantastic.
Do you hope that your kids will read your books one day?
I suppose so, yeah. I think so.
There's probably more pressure there, like for your kids to like them.
I hope that they will. And I hope in that the sort of first major nonfiction book that I wrote doesn't really have much of me in it. Actually, you know, it's much more about kind of general history. And, you know, there's kind of me in the way that I tell the stories. But the book that I'm writing just now is much more of a personal journey in it. And I do hope that, you know, my kids are 7 and 4 at the moment, that when they're older and, you know, I've got to go off travelling to write this book, that they'll kind of understand what I was doing and what I was up to and hopefully appreciate that. And also, in some respects, you know, you talked about never being able to know your parents. Maybe they will understand me better, because I think one of the things that I have to face as a parent is that they will just, you know, at some point think, what was up with that guy? You know, and no. You know, and that's something that you have to grapple with. So I think as a writer, you know, maybe it's a double-edged sword that you're putting something out there that they can then look at and consider. But yeah, I mean, to answer the question, I do hope they read it and appreciate what I was up to in my office, or, you know, going off to the library or going off traveling.
Yeah, I feel like I'm obviously not that old, but I think I still see this difference between adults, as in like my parents' type of adult, and my type of adult, which is like early 20s type of adulting. And I feel like even though we are technically categorized in the same group, it's so different.
My kind of observation about the younger generation, and I was asked to go back, it's one of these weird things, I was asked to go back to my school this summer past, to whoever's kind of top of the year in the school gets something called the Ducks Medal, and a former Ducks Medalist has to come and give the speech sort of presenting to them. So I was asked to come and do this, and I was kind of conflicted about it. I hadn't been back to the school for 20 years. I really want to do this.
And, yeah.
It was quite surreal going back and sitting in the space that the last time I'd been, it was in a church, and the last time I'd been in this church was 1996. And it was just very weird. So I kind of started talking about things that were going on in 1996, like Spice Girls had released their first single, you know, strange things like that. And I was just so unbelievably impressed with their maturity, how prepared they were for the kind of next step for the world. And I was reflecting on what I was like, and they were so much more mature than I was, so much more kind of switched on, so much more resilient. And there's a sense for, you know, almost for my generation to think that it's good that the younger generation appear to be better, kinder, nicer, care more about the planet than, I mean, you know, ultimately I got my fragment, the Berlin Wall, I thought the planet was going to be destroyed. Now it may be being destroyed in a different way.
Yeah.
But maybe it created a kind of fatalism among my generation. To be like, you know, doesn't matter. We're going to blow it all up.
Got the nuclear bunker like 5 minutes away.
Yeah. I mean, I think people are actually trying to confront it, which is really impressive for the younger generation, for the, you know, that generation behind me. But maybe some will have that kind of fatalism about, what can you do? I hope not. I hope not. And I don't think so.
I think it depends on where you come from, because I'm originally Israeli, which has a lot of issues for me because of my very conflicted ideological beliefs. But when I go home, it's, you know, there's just a kind of acceptance of the way things are, because it's so commonplace to believe that, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, the whole society has come to accept, you know, things like the military as essential to our identity as a people, that for us, there's no other option. You know, the people who refuse to go are far and few. And I mean, if you are one of those people, you're very much in a bubble where you see yourselves as, you know, liberals, and you are liberals in the Israeli context, but everyone around you has just accepted it, and no one even thinks about the possibility of changing it. You know, to us it's normal to have bunkers. Every single house has a safe room. The minute you hear a siren, you walk in, it's, don't even think about it twice anymore. And I have friends who are just shocked by the fact that, you know, for us, anyone from 18 to 21 is in the military, and we're not surprised when we hear sirens anymore. And, you know, because I grew up abroad, it still shocks me every once in a while. But that nihilism is entirely there. And I mean, I think it's gone past nihilism, it's just acceptance. And I think that's a bit scary because there are people my age, and I don't know, I always hope that people my age will be the agents of change, because it is, for the most part, in our hands. But, I mean, in Edinburgh, you know, the community is so liberal that you really do feel like something's happening. But the minute you kind of step back and move into a different, you know, context, that whole feeling of hope just kind of dissipates. Just a bit sad. But we definitely feel the whole Berlin Wall thing. We've got our own walls.
I was going to say that, which is far longer than the Berlin Wall, you know, ever was, which, you know, in and of itself is... I mean, it's both terrible and fascinating. Mm. You know, it's actually one of the stories I'm looking at for my new book is the story of that wall and that border.
Yeah.
And trying to understand it, how it came about.
It's hard to understand. I think even people living there don't understand it. I mean, there's the historical context, obviously, and you can understand it in terms of a timeline of events. But understanding the human experience, which I think is almost as important, is very difficult to do because... Even as an outsider who doesn't have any personal involvement in it or has any, you know, anything at stake, it's hard to separate yourself from a bias that you have. And it's impossible to understand both sides when you've got that bias. I mean, logically, you'll say, oh, yeah, I understand, you know, that there's a mutual fear of the possibilities that will occur if we put ourselves in vulnerable positions that come with, you know, peace negotiations. But until you're in it, you can't really understand what the significance of, like, this wall is. I would invite you to visit the country and have a talk with, you know, both Israelis and Palestinians, because it's very interesting to see the different opinions.
I keep hearing the word border over and over. What does crossing a border mean to you?
For me, I think it's university. You know, I grew up in the country, and I think even coming from, you know, a small kind of village in the country to Edinburgh was quite a significant step, and not an easy step. And I think a lot of students will experience that wherever they're coming from to Edinburgh, wherever they're going to university. But I mean, after I left university, I then moved to work in London, and that wasn't as big a jump for me, you know, going to, you know, one of the busiest cities in the world from Edinburgh, which ultimately is just a kind of big town.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it was that first leap when you're sort of 18 to come away from home for the first time. I mean, it is crossing a border, and it's a difficult one. And, you know, and it's easy to want to cross back, whether it's just to get your washing done or, you know, whatever it might be, or to, you know, that sort of side of things. But I was always kind of fascinated by it. There was a book that I read by Cormac McCarthy, who's probably most famous for writing The Road or No Country for Old Men, but there's a series he wrote called The Border Trilogy, which I started reading when I was 15, 16. And particularly the second of those books, The Crossing, which was about this, you know, young man who was same age as me when I was reading, actually, he was 16, who is trying to hunt and trap a wolf in the New Mexico border, And he goes out to try and find this wolf and eventually catches it and decides he's not going to kill it, but he's going to take it back to Mexico. And I kind of read this book and I was just so taken with the landscape and the experience. And I used to go out on my bike of an evening after reading it and kind of, like, you know, I wasn't riding on a horse, but I'd kind of just, I'd just go as far as I could on this old racing bike that used to belong to my uncle and just ride these kind of country roads and just go as far as I could,
you know,
exploring new places and, you know, roads I'd never been down. But the thing is, I could always just, you know, freewheel home, you know, as it started getting darker in those kind of summer evenings, whereas the character in the book, it's not a romantic book. It's a very depressing book, as many of Cormac McCarthy's books are, but it's haunting and it always kind of stayed with me. And you know, this idea of kind of crossing borders and what it means literally and metaphorically, whether it's into manhood or adulthood or into new experiences, I think it's something that has always stayed with me and has always fascinated me.
Mm-hmm. What was the most difficult thing crossing that border from moving from the country to Edinburgh?
I think you're confronted with yourself, you know, in a way that you never are before. When you leave the insulation of your family, you're kind of confronted with who you are or who you want to be or what kind of person you are. And that can be quite stark sometimes. And I think it's that process of trying to mould who you are out with that family environment, out with that support environment that you've always had. You know, I had incredibly supportive parents, you know, so I mean, some people come from much tougher upbringings, much, much tougher upbringings than I ever would. I don't know whether that makes it easier or harder, but it's an experience that everyone has to have of going out by themselves. And again, you know, I talked about my children earlier on. It's weird to think about them doing that because I can't imagine it. Mm. I can't imagine, and I guess I can't imagine a time where I'm not worrying about them, which probably gives me insight into what my parents, you know, were thinking when I'd kind of gone away.
Yeah, my parents have told me that too. That it's like weird not having control over what their kids are doing.
But yeah. Even, you know, I talked about going out on my bike. I used to do that at 6, no helmet, mm-hmm. just riding country roads. The idea of my 7-year-old being out on his bike, it just wouldn't happen. No one does that. No one really lets their kids do that now. And I mean, I was having this conversation with my partner the other night about it, you know, that sense of, you know, are they going to be more or less resilient than we were because of things like that? All the same, I do think my kids do seem more resilient than I was. So something must be working. But it's, you know, it's kind of reflecting on, I guess, the kind of latitude we were given, you know, at that time. And this was the early 1980s, you know, and there was much less control over what you did. I suppose that, you know, your own, talking about borders again, those own kind of personal borders were further away, were kind of wider. There was less scrutiny. There was no social media. You know, you could be more anonymous,
yeah.
And probably could experience things more without it being monitored in any particular way.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to piggyback onto your idea because it's a lot easier when someone brings up their own and you understand that you relate to it. I don't think mine was university though. I left home when I was 16 because I was very, very lucky and I got a scholarship to go to a boarding school, and that boarding school was just outside Tel Aviv. So for me, that wasn't just, you know, crossing the border of, you know, moving from one country to another that are vastly different, or, you know, crossing the border of leaving home. It was, I think, not to be political, because I promised myself I wouldn't be, but we've already thrown that out the window. I think having to move to that boarding school was very challenging for me in terms of challenging my beliefs. You know, when you grow up with your parents, even if they try not to, you know, force their beliefs on you, you do grow up in a household where they're talked about, especially with my parents. You know, they were always open about their beliefs, about the conflict, their beliefs about the way that the country works. And leaving home and all of a sudden having that opportunity to kind of form my own beliefs, especially in my school, which was, it's a very special boarding school. It's composed of 20% Israeli students, 20% Palestinian and other Arab students, and 60% internationals. And their aim is to kind of humanize the whole conflict. It brings together students, and you live together in the same rooms, in the same building for 2 years, and you form incredible friendships. I mean, my best friend to this day was someone that I met at boarding school. And when you're confronted with so many different beliefs and so many different lived experiences outside of home, outside of, like, you know, the beliefs of your parents and the beliefs of your family, you are, you know, it's massive. It's a massive shift. It's hard being challenged as a person. I think anyone faces difficulties when they're challenged. And I think that for me was possibly the biggest border I crossed, because it really made me call into question everything I believed in. And I think that was really important, because I went into school being extremely ashamed of the fact that I'm Israeli. You know, to me it was awful. It was the worst thing I could be. And I think I left the school having a little more appreciation for who I am. I don't condone the way that the country works, because we're not going to do that. And I think that was a very big transformation for me, because I think I'm a lot more comfortable with my identity now than I was before I moved. So it was a really transformative experience, and was, you know, crossing a border in both a metaphorical sense and a literal sense. And I'm very thankful for that experience, because it was so difficult. But I think the difficult ones are the ones that make you grow the most. And
yeah. Was it easier to move to Edinburgh after that?
Oh yeah, for sure. Because I didn't move straight to Edinburgh. I had a bit of a hard time with mental health, and I got a psychological exemption from serving in the military. But I had to stay there for a year to, you know, get all the paperwork processed. So I was there for a year, and I was living in a flat with 2 30-year-old flatmates while I was 18, and, you know, working as a waitress at a 24/7 diner. And it was the first time being a proper adult. So moving to Edinburgh after that was very easy. It was very easy.
So did that feel like limbo then?
Oh, it was awful. It was awful. It was a really difficult period of time for me because I was also the youngest person working in the restaurant because everyone there was either, you know, after university or just finished the army. So they were all at least 22 and above. And my Hebrew still isn't the strongest it could be because I did grow up outside of Israel and it's a very hard language to learn. So I was waitressing in both Hebrew and English and French and Spanish and my brain was just a jumble and I wasn't doing well. And the minute I got that exemption, I was out of there. I had saved enough money waitressing to be able to go and backpack through South America for 5 months before uni.
Ooh.
It was good fun. Nice. It was the exact amount of time I needed to kind of get my brain sorted before coming here because it's just a very difficult period of time. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know how long it'll take you. You have to talk to countless people that you don't want to talk about. And you're constantly talking about, you know, difficulties that you faced with mental illness and that's never an easy thing to talk about, let alone someone you've never met and someone you have to convince that you're mentally ill enough not to have to serve in the military. It's not a fun time, but I guess, you know, you do what you've got to do. And it was helpful. It also helped me come to terms with, you know, my mental illness and the fact that I have it and it's part of who I am and I'm still human for it. So having to talk over it all the time definitely made it more normal.
Yeah, 100%.
Which was nice.
Yeah.
And now I'm totally okay with it. And yes. I tell everyone about it. Breaking Definitely. The stigma. What about you?
I would also piggyback on your answer. I think going to university was quite the change. I also come from quite a small town in Norway. So moving from that to... I did my first year in Canada. And it just wasn't the place for me. I mean, I skied a lot. I had a lot of fun. But at the end of the day, I think I chose the wrong university. So I came here and it was better, but it was also hard because I obviously came into second year and everyone had been here for a year. But I think I also came into the right time because I feel like a lot of people make the wrong friends in first year.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So when I came, everyone was still looking for friends. So it wasn't that difficult at the end of the day. First and second year were definitely hard. But now we've gotten used to everything and it's nice.
Thriving. Thriving. Not surviving, thriving.
Yes. Definitely. I was meaning to ask you whether your kids or you ever did when you were young, if you read Calvin and Hobbes.
I didn't. I think my brother did. So I think, I must have picked it up. I always remember people raved about it, but I like this really dark stuff. way too young because I had this older brother. My older brother was like 3.5 years older than me. So this comic, 2000 AD, from four, before I could even read, I was picking it up and looking at the pictures.
Oh, man.
So, you know, the kind of Peanuts or Calvin and Hobbes, it was too light. Yeah. It wasn't about sort of apocalypse and mutual destruction. So I wasn't in.
Enough existentialism. Not enough there to make you question everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, that sounds kind of angsty.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I was watching like Footloose as well and things like that. You know, it was all sorts. I mean, actually, you mentioned Norway. My dad worked in the oil industry, so there was a summer that I stayed in Stavanger, and
that's where I'm from.
Okay, it rained the whole time.
Yes,
I was six
that
years
sounds
old.
Sounds like
I was
Stavanger.
6 years old, maybe 7 years old. So there was nothing to do apart from go to the video shop on the corner, which had British movies, and we would rent these films and watch like 3 a day. At that really formative age, I was mainlining sort of John Hughes movies, things like The Breakfast Club and, you know, Flashdance, Rocky, all the Rocky films, up to Rocky 3, I think, by that point. Ridiculous.
Oh, all the
So it's had a real impact on Top Gun, I think, might have been in there. No, that's probably a bit later. So, yeah, so I kind of like all these things impact on your worldview, you realise, when you're older.
You keep mentioning, like, childhood in different forms. Do you find that you remember a lot from your childhood?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do a lot. I mean, a lot.
Yeah. Seems like it.
Quite vividly. Maybe more so again now, as I say, because I have children, you think about it more. But I mean, I think I've always had a pretty good memory, a very sort of visual memories. There's, you know, strong visual cues for things. You know, probably going back till I was about 3 years old, I can remember. And partly because we moved around. So because of the industry my dad worked in, I was born in Shetland. But that was because he was working on a construction project up there for a big oil refinery. So my whole family were there. But then we moved to Singapore. So we went from Shetland, 6 months old, went to Singapore and was there for another 3 years. And I remember being in Singapore, which means I must have been 3 years old. And then we moved back to Scotland and kind of stayed there pretty much ever since. But I guess having those key moments at that point of your life probably helped trigger those memories and help you access them.
Definitely. What about you?
No, I don't remember anything. I'm also 21. I should be able to remember these things, but I don't. Like, I can barely remember what I did yesterday. There are some things I remember, but my parents always say that it's probably because I looked at the photographs, and I think there's something there. You know, I'll look at the photographs and I'll remember that instant, but I don't know if I remember it right, because all I remember is just that split second.
Yeah. What's your earliest memory?
Oh, man. I don't know. Everyone asks this one question, and I never know because I can't organise them chronologically. You know, it's all kind of jumbled. Mm. So I do have this one memory from, I think I was around 3.5, and we were on holiday in Zanzibar, which is an island off the coast of Tanzania. My dad is a tour operator, so we used to go on holiday quite often. And I was in this blue bathing suit, and I was sat in the bathroom, and the bathroom was like painted a vivid blue, and there's palm trees outside, and I remember that. But I think that's because I'd seen the photo. You know, it's all these memories that you think you have, then all of a sudden someone like changes a detail about it, and you're like, wait, do I remember this or not? Am I imagining this?
The last question I'm going to ask you is, if you could associate your object with one word, what would it be?
Well, border is kind of the obvious one. I'll associate it with writing, actually. Writing, because that's such a big part of my life, and that's why I have it.
Well, I guess mine would be childhood, which also fits in quite a bit. I can't think of anything else it would be. It is just
childhood. And why?
Could be the fact that it's been such a stable aspect throughout my entire evolution. Can I call it that? I feel like a Pokemon.
Your own evolution.
Referring to myself as someone who's evolved. But it has. It's such a small thing, and it's something that I forget about all the time, but all of a sudden every time, English today, I can't speak. Every
You're
time I feel
great.
A bit too old, this kind of grounds me. You know, I've had it all the way through, and I realise how young I really am. And that's so deep for a comic book, but it's true. This comic book has managed to pop up when I need it most, even though I've forgotten it exists.
But it's more than just a what it contains. It's the object.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things I love most about books as physical objects. You know, I've got this massive bookshelf at home, and, you know, that bookshelf that I have is in its own way a memory capsule where I can look at each of those books on the shelf and think about where I was when I was reading it. You know, was I abroad?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the covers got that sort of slight curve to it because I was reading it beside the sea. Or it was when I first started university, I was reading that book. Or when I'd moved to London, it was one of the books I was reading when I was first engaging with what it was like to live and to work in London. And not to have that would be a great loss to my life. Not be able to look at that shelf and think about all those memories that each of those individual books essentially hold because of when I came across them. And then sometimes to go back and reread those books and understand them in a different way, as you've done with yours. You know, that's why I would, you know, one of the things I would say to everybody is buy books and keep them, because they're more than just the, you know, what's between the pages. They're an object that will have resonance further down the line in your life, and they can be very important.
I totally agree with that. Like, when I go home now, which doesn't happen as frequently as I'd like it to, like home, you know, Tanzania, I'll have my bookshelf in my bedroom, and I'll have all these books that I'd not read since I was really young, and it's always so nice to kind of peruse through them. And that's also why I really love secondhand books. To me, it's just such a weird concept that someone once owned it, and then, you know, there's like a little dog ear because someone had been interrupted, and it's so crazy to think that someone might have been interrupted because, I don't know, their cat's knocked, I don't know, a mug off of the kitchen table, or because they got a bad phone call, or because they just decided they wanted to go to sleep. Just the infinite realities that might exist within these books is just such a wild concept. It's the same thing with our books as well. Like, the books that I own will have marks on them, and I'll forget why they have those marks, but it's so intriguing to think, what was I doing then, you know?
But also the strange things you've used as markers.
Oh, exactly.
It might be a receipt, exactly. Or it might be, you know, an old sort of university ID card, you know, something like that, that suddenly, I haven't thought about that book in ages. Yeah. You pick it up and something falls out. Buy books.
Yeah,
buy books. That's honestly a great way to leave this episode. Thank you for being on Sharing Things.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to Sharing Things. Join us next time when we talk with Peter Matheson and Christine DeLuca about early memories, unexpected generosity, and maritime connections. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform to catch our next episode.